Hi, my name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic. Can I lower this a little? Where's Conan? Oh, can I? I'm still a little funny about things in my peripheral vision. I start batting at things. stuff in the corner of my eye. In fact, I might have to take off the corsage. I am sober, though. I just want you to know. But thank you. That's actually one of my favorite stories from my home group. Some people were playing softball, as they do, or baseball, and a new guy came up to bat and was standing there, and just as he did, I guess it had rained the night before, and this big swarm of little gnats came flying around him, and he just stood there frozen at the plate until somebody yelled out, "We see him too!" And then he, like, oh, thank God, you know. And that's really, I'm so glad to be in a room full of people that, you know, you see it too. You do. Yeah, that's what AA has done for me. I'm not alone. I want to thank the committee for inviting me up here. It's nice to be here. I especially want to thank Don and Paul for being on standby for hours and hours last night and finally coming out about 2:30, I guess, in the morning this morning to pick me up at the airport. There are a lot of delays. I appreciate that and appreciate their hospitality. And then I got all dressed up and went down to my, I wasn't really paying attention last night or this morning, whenever it was. And I went down to the lobby of my hotel for the brass band luncheon, but it wasn't there, it was here. So they were kind enough to leap in the car and come and get me. But anyway, I'm glad that I finally made it here. And check my watch here. I want to welcome the new people who may be here, our new members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and welcome you home. And I would like you to know, if you haven't figured it out yet, that there is absolutely something extraordinary about what you are sitting in. A works and it works well. I have no doubt about that. And it's not just going to work, you know, later on or somewhere else or, you know, in the big scheme of things. It is working at this moment, in this time and in this place. I'm sober 19 years. It's a long time between cocktails for somebody like me. And I've gotten some big things, or what have been to me big things in sobriety, but there's also the little things that just really let me know that A works. You know, Richard called me several months ago and asked me to do this, and I said that I would, and he said he would be here, and I said I would be here, and we were both here. And, you know, something like this takes a lot of planning. When I got here today, as I do any meeting I go to, the lights are on, the chairs are set up, the coffee is made, there was people at the door to welcome me. I mean, this is all done by alcoholics. How that can be, I don't know, you know, because that is not who we are. It's just not who we are. I left my car at Burbank Airport, and it's an AA car, so it has like 150,000 miles and on it and two hubcaps. But I have a license to drive it over there in my purse. And with my current address. I have an insurance card for that car. I have tags that are current on the license plate, and I bought those tags. I did not take a straight-edge razor blade and scrape those tags off anybody else's license plate. Those are my tags. And A works. It really does. That's not how I used to live. That is not the life I brought to you. And I used to think that freedom was in having no responsibility, and if people would just get off my back and just leave me alone, you know, I'd be fine. And you taught me, actually, it's precisely the opposite. And in fact, in the Satisfactions of Right Living, it talks about that, about service gladly rendered and obligations squarely met, that these are the satisfactions of right living. And I have found that it's in facing the responsibilities is where I get freedom. And I don't like it. I don't like being an adult. But when I do it in spite of myself, I get a measure of freedom that I didn't even know that was the way to get it. I didn't even know that. And the odd thing is that I learned it right here in these rooms. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I was raised in a loving family with good values and so on, but I couldn't hear it from them. But for whatever reason, I can hear it from you, and I'm very grateful for that. I really am. I I was born, maybe I should start there, now I'll progress rapidly. I grew up in Northern California in Santa Cruz, and actually not quite this part of the country. My grandparents on my dad's side are from like Humboldt and Del Norte County, way up at the top of California there, so spent a lot of time in Crescent City and Hiuchi and that area, on the California-Oregon border, and it's nice to be in this part of the country. So I grew up in this, you know, I used to think I had this really kind of tragic childhood on a grand scale, but I've been brought down to right size here, thank God. I've learned how to not take myself so seriously, and that's another freedom, and I still have a long ways to go with that, but that has been wonderful, to just, you know, that kind of to drop the rock. And I this childhood that I had that I used to think was, you know, I mean, it wasn't whatever. We, you know, our Christmas lights stayed up all year. The garbage cans were out all week, you know, that kind of thing. Sometimes the power would be cut off. Sometimes the phone would be cut off. Lots of broken windows at our house. I remember one time the glass man had been there for like the third time in a week. And as he was leaving, he said to my mom, "Lady, you're the captain of a strange ship." And that kind of described life at our house. My dad was a trucker and a hard hat, and he'd be gone for long stretches of time on construction jobs and stuff, and my mom was the one that kind of held it all together. She was the librarian in our town. I'm the youngest of four. But there was, you know, my dad, sometimes she'd have to go pick him up out of jail, or his drinking buddies would think it'd be funny to put cage full of roosters on the front porch at, you know, dawn on a Sunday morning, so they'd wake up the neighborhood. The neighbors never really liked us. And my mom, but she would certainly have her breaking points, even though she kind of tried to hold it together. And I love to tell the story about her, that she was at the library and there was a leaky faucet that they weren't fixing, and one day she snapped and she called down to City Hall and said, "If you don't get someone here to fix this leaky faucet, I'm going to run nude down Woodrow Avenue with a sign around my neck that says I work for the city of Santa Cruz and I've been driven mad by a leaky faucet." So this is kind of my gene pool here. I should tell you, my grandfather, was working in my life long before I ever picked up a drink. My grandfather got sober down in Eureka, I think it's sometime in the early 40s, and stayed sober. And I have his big book. It's a first edition, 11th printing. He died when I was 14, when I was just starting to drink, but I went up there and was able to get his big book after I got sober. But my father moved out when I was about 10 or 12 or so. He didn't go far. He went down the street with another woman and her children, which only in A is that funny. But see, that's what I mean about not, you know, I don't want to, do I want to carry that around and be bitter? No, I don't. I want to, you know, I want to walk free. And it's that laughter that, you know, and I know that when we laugh at all that stuff, it's because we're in the lifeboat, you know, because we don't live that way anymore, or we're not bound up by that stuff anymore. And it delights me no end. But anyway, when he moved out, it was my grandfather as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm assuming. He never talked about being an AA member, but his actions spoke louder than any words he could have ever said. And he was the one who, you know, helped my mom to make the house payment. And she took in boarders and did other things, but he helped her make the house payment. And we were able to have vacations because of him. He had a place on the Eel River, and we'd go there. And he put braces on my teeth. And you know, he kind of stepped in and did the things where my father was not able to do, because, you know, he was in his own disease. And my grandfather. And perhaps he was making living amends. He'd been a Skid Row drunk when my father was a child, and he certainly was a wonderful father figure to my siblings and I, and I'm very grateful for that. And there's no doubt in my mind it's because he was a sober member of this program. He paid the tuition so I could stay in the Catholic school that I loved, and I don't mean to offend anybody here, but I loved Catholic school. That's just my experience. I don't think I'm recovering from that. I don't think I'm, and that's just my experience. I have people, I'm grateful for the education that I received there. I think too, because there's a lot kind of that kind of low grade chaos in the alcoholic home, that at that school and in that parish, there is some structure there and some order. And I'm a teacher today, and I know that those things are important in a child's life. And I knew what to wear, I knew what to do. The world is a confusing and frightening place to me, but if you tell me, and that's why A is good for me, you give me a plan for living, and you give me some direction, and I can do that. And it was like that at that school. I had fine examples, people who are living lives of meaning and purpose, and concepts like service were not new concepts to me when I got to you, but they were ones that I had lost, and I couldn't find my way back to as hard as I tried. And you showed me the way back to those things, and I'm very, very grateful for that. When I graduated from that school, it went up to the eighth grade, and the morning after my eighth grade graduation, I had won some pins and stuff, and I came out to the kitchen table, and my mom was sitting there with my diploma and the little awards that I'd won, and she said to me, "Ken, I finally got my scholar." And I can tell you that maybe a year later, year and a half later or something like that, I was standing in front of my mom again. I had started to drink by this time, was the difference. And I was standing behind the counter at the local Derwiener Schnitzel. I don't know if you have Derwiener Schnitzel here, but it's fast food. And I was working there full time. I had dropped out of high school with a 0.8 GPA, and my mom was there because I hadn't been home the night before, and maybe not the night before that. And she was standing there and trying not to cry and saying, "You know, I don't understand what's happened to you. You used to be so active." And she meant in our parish and so on. And I didn't understand it either. It's clear to me now I'm one of those alcoholics. I took the drink and the drink took me. I was only 22 when I got sober. I did not feel young at the time. It seems young now, but I didn't know what it was at the time, and so I said the things that we say to people that get in the way of our drinking, you know. And I love my mother as much on that day as I do today, but I didn't know it, but she was in between me and my drinking, and so I said the things that we say, you know, "Get out of here, leave me alone, you don't care, you don't love me," whatever, you know, check one of any of those things, just to get out of my face and not make me have to look at what I'm doing and the toll that it's taking on you, frankly. And, you know, stuff like that was trying to happen, and I didn't like to, you know. I can remember one morning, and that was never the plan. It was never supposed to be one morning. It was supposed to be one night. And, you know, and I would never say, "Well, I'm going to go out tonight and, you know, not come home for a few days, and then I'll have to hide in the bushes when I see my mom driving around town looking for me frantically." And, you know, that was never the plan. I never wanted, you know, to do that, but that often ended up happening. And I had been out all night yet again, and I'm wearing the clothes the night before. I'm sick. I have the shakes. Some guy's driving me home, and my mom hadn't gone to work yet, and she was probably delaying it as long as she could, to see if I was going to come home. And she finally had to go to work. I couldn't go in there and face her, and so I had him drop me off around the corner, and I sat on a curb, and I shivered and shook, and she finally left. I saw her car go down the street, and I went in the house, and there was a note from her on the refrigerator that said, "Don't you realize what it does to me when you do this?" And yes, I did. Of course I did, but I was powerless to stop. And I thought, you know, maybe it's this town. Santa Cruz is kind of a party place, and if I can just get away from my friends. And so that was my, and of course, you know, there was a boyfriend involved and craziness there. And, you know, I am really good at, people used to say to me, "Oh, you're so brave, you're so worldly," because I'd like run off. I went up to China at one point, and I'm terrified. I'm not brave at all. I'm terrified. I can get on a plane with a black eye and a hangover and a one-way ticket. That's easy, and a pair of dark glasses. Show up at the DMV, that's the stuff I don't know how to do. And I'd see people in my age group, their lives were moving on, and I couldn't figure out, you know, what was the problem. Anyway, so I decided if I could get away from this hometown, that it would all be different. And I had an older sister. She was only 19. She seemed a lot older. She was living in Honolulu. She just had a little baby, and she was raising him on her own and was on welfare and practicing our disease, and that sounded like a plan to me. And so I got a one-way ticket and got on a plane and went over there and moved in with her and enrolled in a high school long enough to just meet the other people who didn't go to class. You know, that it was no different there, because wherever you go, there you are. And things didn't get any better there. They got worse. And we ended up losing our apartment, and we were homeless for a while, just a few weeks, but it seemed like a long time. And we didn't sleep on the street or anything like that, but we had, you know, we were staying with different friends, and people were not too happy to put us up, these two teenage girls and a baby and our, you know, food stamps. And the high school thing didn't, you know, of course that didn't pan out, and it never didn't really occur to me to get a job either. I didn't know what I was doing. And you know, to make matters, I can remember this one Easter Sunday getting off a city bus, and I had everything, all my belongings in a pillowcase, and going to stay at, yet again, you know, some people that we were mooching off of, and just thinking something's really wrong with my life here. You know, it's Easter Sunday. I should have gone to Mass this morning. I should be with my family. What is wrong here? But I couldn't quite connect it with the drinking yet. And to make matters worse, though, I got drunk and I got pregnant in that order. And, you know, I can remember being on the beach, Waikiki Beach, and being really hungover and sick, and having to keep going out into the water with my back to the beach to vomit. And every time I'd come back and lay down, my sister would try to talk me into entering one of the bikini contests at the bars, because we really needed the $50. And I'm so glad I have different choices today. You know, I just can remember that feeling of like in between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, how did I get here? And anyway, I terminated that pregnancy, and I'm not here to moralize about that for anybody. But for me, it had been not even a year before that, but I'd been confirmed in the Catholic Church and in that faith that was very important to me. And quite frankly, that was a line that I was, you know, not planning on crossing. And now I have to drink, because I can't stand the way that I feel that I'm when I'm sober, and the remorse and the guilt and the shame and I don't know, things just seem to just speed up from that point. And so I decided Hawaii is the problem, and what before was going to be the answer, now it's the problem, and what was the problem is now going to be the answer. And so the answer is now back to California, back to my hometown. And I went back there, and that's when my restaurant career started at the Derwiener Schnitzel. And, you know, I didn't know I was going to work in restaurants for the next 17 years and the first 11 years of my sobriety. And there's nothing wrong with doing that kind of work, but I was never happy doing it. And it was just going to be a temporary job until my real life started, you know. And I carried that delusion with me for years into sobriety. An old-timer that I love in my home group, Marianne, says she never knew the difference between a fantasy and a plan. And, yeah, it's a good one, isn't it? It just describes me. Anyway, I'm working at the Derwiener Schnitzel, and around this time I met him and Mr. Wright. He's currently Mr. D85602 to the warden at Soledad Penitentiary, but at the time he seemed really charming. And, you know, my dates were starting to say things like, you smell like a brewery, and what are those slash marks on your wrist, and my mom says you can't come over, and, you know, why'd you do that last night? And he didn't say any of that stuff. He woke up with the shakes like I did. I didn't have to hide my drinking. If I smelled like booze in the morning, it was no big deal. And so, you know, it was love. That was my soulmate. But you know what? Things are just getting, just seem to be moving, you know, speeding up even more and getting crazier. And wasn't too long that relationship got violent. And as Sue mentioned, you know, I was certainly a part of the violence in that relationship, and it just got crazier. I ended up losing. He never worked, but he'd help me steal money from the Derwiener Schnitzel and that kind of stuff. And I ended up losing that job. I think I quit just before I was fired. Not an easy thing to do. Even Derwiener Schnitzel has standards. But I'd been drinking on the beach all day, and I showed up there drunk, and I got into a shoving match with another employee in the parking lot, and she and I were rolling around in broad daylight in the Derwiener Schnitzel parking lot. And I ran through the back door and made a scene behind the counter. And, you know, there's just something so pathetic about, you know, a drunken woman defending her job at the fast food restaurant. I think I quit just before I was fired, and then I went across town and got a job at the Great American Wiener Works, and I was going to show them. And you know, that was a step up because they serve beer, and I have a tendency to look like a nice girl, and this is a little mom-and-pop place, and those people trusted me, and so now I'm, you know, loading cases of beer out the back door and filling up from the tap there when they're on break. And, you know, it's just, I purchased this car around this time, and of course, no driver's license, no registration, no insurance. I didn't get any of that stuff until I got sober. I guess I think I was 24 when I got a driver's license. Because I don't know how you did that kind of stuff. It was just so difficult. It just seemed so hard. And I can remember going to try and get birth control, thinking I've got to get this under control here. And, you know, first off, if I can even make the appointment would be one thing. And then if I could show up, and then to follow through. You know, you get there and they'd say, what was the first day of your last period? And I would think, who would know that? I tried. It just seemed difficult. So I had this car, and, you know, and I would have little accidents, and, you know, and it was a pretty good car initially, but, you know, by the end there, it had no brakes and no brake lights, and I just learned how to downshift and use the emergency brake to stop. And one night I went flying through the parking lot, and I thought there was a driveway there, but there wasn't. It was just the curb, and then something called the tie rod broke, but it still drove. And there had been some sort of an electrical fire down in the on the passenger side, so the carpet down there was all burned up. And then there was the window on this side, the handle didn't work, and so you just kept a book of matches, you know, to keep the window up. But it would fall down from time to time as the matchbook would get more mushed. And one day it just fell down and shattered, and so it just stayed that way. It was just, you know, extra breezy. I mean, it's just, oh, it just was just always a problem. And then to get a license for all that, no. So blackouts weren't anything new to me. They weren't so cute anymore. I don't want to know what I did or what I said or who I was with. And this one particular morning, I woke up and there was this weight on my chest, and I knew that, you know, it hadn't been a good night. And I thought it had something to do with my car. And I went out, and I was, you know, living at home at this time. I just turned 18, and there was the car in my mom's garage, and it was all, you know, one side was all smashed in. And I found myself looking through the newspaper the next day to see if I'd, you know, hit anyone or killed anyone. Or there were big pieces missing off of it. And I, you know, driving back across town to look for those pieces, which I never found. And I don't know what I did that night or who I hit. To this day, I don't know. But, you know, suddenly Hawaii didn't look so bad after all. And the place now that, you know, now it's the answer again. And I put that car in my mom's garage and let her deal with it. And that, again, I couldn't get away from that boyfriend that was just getting crazier and more violent. So I went back to Honolulu. As I said, I had just turned 18. Drinking age was 18 at that time in Hawaii. And I got a job in a bar. God, it was so glamorous when I got that job, and we had $1.50 drinks and four bands a day and two Elvis impersonators, and I just thought it was the most fanciest job. And 6 years later, when I was still working, I didn't quite feel the same way. And I got to go back there and talk last Easter, and I went back to that bar. Now, I'm 41. I went to work there when I was 18. Two of those bands are still there. So, you know, it's going to be yet another fresh start. It's all going to be different. But, you know, and I'm just crossing those lines. And by the time I was 19, I was on my fourth abortion. And how had that happened? And, you know, I'd never planned on living that way. And I thought, you know, I did not know or think that I could ever redeem a life like that, or that there was no, you know, I was just kind of, my former sponsor, Karen, says I drank and I drank and I died 1,000 times. Because I just, you know, I just was kind of waiting to die, just kind of circling the drain there. I ended up drinking in the strip bars in the red light districts in Honolulu. If there's any military personnel here, what we call the Korean bars or the hostess bars, because we seek lower companions. And I could look at those women doing what they were doing and think, well, you know, at least I'm not doing that. And I couldn't go out to the nightclubs or things like that anymore, because you want me to do things like dance and have a conversation. And I can't do those things because they cut into my drinking time. And furthermore, towards the end there, I don't know if I can have a conversation or not, Because sometimes, I mean, I have this huge capacity for alcohol, but now there's times when I'm stone cold sober on the inside, but I might have one or two drinks, and I'm starting to slur and fall down, and strange things are happening to me, and I've developed a stutter, and my hair's falling out, my gums are receding from malnutrition. I'm starting to hear voices and things calling on my skin, and I didn't know if alcohol was taking me to crazy, if it was keeping me from going there, you know, and I started to get into that place where I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it, and I had gotten involved with a married man, one of the Elvis's bass players, and that was a disaster. And he was trying to not want to come around anymore because of the way that I lived. And I just thought that he was, you know, he was paranoid and uptight. And you know, I ended up living in an apartment that was very much like the house I grew up in. The first phone call that I made to you guys was from a payphone. At a liquor store because our phone was cut off and I couldn't go in that. And I didn't drive. I never drove again after. You know, I wanted this big, broad, colorful life like most alcoholics do. And my life just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I no longer drove because all that stuff gets in the way of my drinking. So all those other things, and, you know, they're peripheral. They've got to fall away. And I couldn't go in that liquor store anymore because I'd been drunk and profane in there. And that meant that I had to, the next closest liquor store, I had to run across a freeway off-ramp and scramble up an embankment and cut through a hole in a chain-link fence to get to the liquor store. And it never occurred to me that there's anything unusual about that at all. I mean, that's where the alcohol is. What's the big deal, you know? But, you know, what becomes normal for us is really, it's quite frightening in retrospect. So this boyfriend of mine, as I said, this apartment, oftentimes the phone would be cut off or the power would be cut off. We had it was between this freeway off ramp and the city bus yard, and there was all these wild cats that lived in the city bus yard, and we had louvered windows. It was my sister and I, and unfortunately my nephew, who was about 8 when I got sober, and these louvered windows, the bottom 6 or so were always broken out, and these wild cats would come in through the city bus yard and go in through those, through our windows, and they'd spray all over and eat out of our trash. It seemed like a little more than we could handle. There was a big wet spot by the front door. We had plumbing problems, and I know today you call a plumber, you call your landlord, but that, you know, it's just, I don't know, we were always going to get around to it, you know. But other things got in the way, and I just got better at, you know, I'd come home and you'd jump over the wet spot and get the cats out. And at that time I was making plenty of money, but I think my rent was like $150 a month, but I was renting my bedroom out and sleeping on the living room floor because I couldn't seem to make the rent. It always ended up in the bars or at, you know, at my cocaine dealer. And as I said, this boyfriend of mine, you know, doesn't want to come around that much. And I remember this one afternoon, I had been injured at work, got some stitches on my ankle. But before I went into the emergency room, I sat down and started drinking, of course, and then was drunk by the time I got to the emergency room. And they stitched up my ankle and sent me home. And I think they could see I could self-medicate, so they didn't give me anything for the pain. He came over the next day, and I was still, you know, kind of half hungover. When you're still kind of partly drunk and the hangover is coming on and you're hoping you can get it just right in there when you can start drinking again before you start feeling the hangover. And he said, you know, look at your ankle, and that place where the stitches were was just black with fleas. And, you know, I dine out on that story a lot, but if I ever think there's any glamour left in the cocktail for me, I want to keep that image really fresh in my mind, you know. Or if I ever think it's not convenient to go to bed at 3:30 in the morning, or, you know, answer my phone or show up at my regular meetings and do the little jobs that I have to do there, I want to remember that. I don't ever want AA to get in the way of the good life that it gave me, because it's given me a very, very good life. And what I'm asked to do here for what I get is very, very small in comparison for the life I've gotten in return. You know, that day came for me, just nothing was working. By this time now, sometimes I wake up in the night and I'm in just a full-throated scream, and I'm convinced there's somebody under my bed or out on my lanai, or, you know, and as I said, voices and things crawling on my skin, or sometimes I might have like a 12-hour crying jag. I'll just can't stop, just drink and cry and drink and cry, and all kinds of strange things are happening to me, and barely holding on to that cocktail waitress job. And this one day, it was just a new level of desperation. And the difference between that day and a lot of the other days, I guess, was that I started to pray, and I hadn't been able to do that in so long because I just thought, you know, I'm past that point. And it was I always kept a bottle of vodka in the freezer, and that wasn't working either. You know, I'd suck on that bottle and put it back in, and just nothing was working. I was terrified, and I guess all the events of that day I attribute to the prayers that I started to say. And I went down to the payphone at the liquor store, and I called my boss. I didn't have anybody in my life to call. And he and I drank together, and his wife had recently been released from the hospital with the DTs. She had been drinking and fell backwards off of lanai, off a balcony. And then when she was in the hospital, she went into the DTs. We were all drinking buddies. And so the big A word had been said, alcoholism. And so I called him, and he came and got me, and I was sick and shaking, and he said, you know, you need a drink. Let's go get a drink. And it must have been the prayer, because I said to him, no, take me to the hospital. And that was the best I could come up with, take me to the hospital. And I didn't know, you know, I know what I was hoping for there, a little Valium and a little sympathy, in that order. Give me the Valium first, and while I'm waiting for that to kick in, you can hold my hand and tell me how sad it all is and how someone here is going to take care of me and someone here is going to make this all go away and someone is going to fix my life. And I got neither of those things, and I'm really, really grateful. First is that I saw a nurse, and I said to her, I can probably stop the cocaine, but I can't stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. And my secret was out, and she said to me, my boyfriend's an alcoholic, and he goes to AA. And it wasn't one alcoholic relating to another, but in that moment, I really felt like I took the first step. I just gave it up. I just laid it out there. And then I saw a doctor who I thought was really cruel at the time, and he said, you know what, we can't help you. You're an alcoholic. You're an addict. Here's some phone numbers, which were to treatment centers. And I just remember thinking, like, you're supposed to help people, and that's exactly what he did. And I'm so grateful that he did not medicalize my problem, you know, a little prescription, something for my nerves. And it's not necessarily that he didn't care. It's that he didn't have an answer. He simply did not have an answer, and he didn't pretend to have an answer. The answer was in those phone numbers that he gave me. As a result of making calls to those places, I found myself in my first AA meeting. I did not go into treatment, but I went to my first AA meeting. I did not come here and feel like I was home by any stretch of the imagination. I would see you guys laughing and talking and smiling and think, I'm never going to feel like that. I'll never have that light in my eyes. I'll never be comfortable in my skin like that. I just know that I won't. But there's a couple things that I got a home group. That was a Steps to Freedom group. They still meet on Tuesday nights in Honolulu. And they used to say a lot in those days to hang with the winners, and that ended up happening for me, not because I knew what that meant, but because all those winners, this was 1985, a lot of people were going into treatment then. And I don't have any opinion on that either way, but there were not a lot of wet drunks coming into AA at that time. Honolulu was kind of a small AA community at that time. And they were really happy to see me, and those people, all those people are still sober today, and that core group of people that kind of swept me up with them. And, you know, I just, as scary as those early days of sobriety were, and they were, I can remember going to my first, it was something like this. It was at Christmas time, and it was an alcathon that they'd have, and it was maybe about this size, but it seemed like there was 10,000 people there. And I got dressed up, and I didn't know, by the time I'd get ready to go out the door to a meeting, my bed would just be piled with clothes, because I didn't know who I was, and I'd have to try on all these different outfits. I'm like, what's the AA outfit? I didn't know, because, you know, it's not a bar, and it's not church, and after that, I was spent. I didn't know it. So I put on a little Christmas dress, and I got there, and somebody looked at me wrong, I thought, and I got myself into the bathroom, and I couldn't get out. I was terrified. I couldn't get out, and I had convinced myself that this person was out there telling all of you. My thinking was so that he was out walking around telling all of you guys that I was a prostitute, as if it would matter in an AA meeting anyway. And that when I got out, And when I got out of that bathroom, you were going to tell me that I have to leave. And I climbed up on the toilet and took down the vent and was going to try and get up that way. It took quite a while to get my thinking. And I finally got myself out of that bathroom. But I was just terrified. But at the same time, it was also clear to me that I was living in a state of grace. And something remarkable was happening in my life because I wasn't drinking. I couldn't believe it. I remember going to buy a big book. I went, and I could have gotten it at a meeting. I had 17 days of sobriety because I was going to meetings, but I wanted to go to the headquarters, you know, and so I went to the central office, which was between these two Korean bars that I used to drink at. I think it's the same, it's still there. And I went and I said, "Like to buy a big book," and they said, "Are you new?" And I said, "No, I have 17 days." And I still don't think it's that funny, actually, because... Now, you and I know that is a long, that was impossible. That was impossible. I couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it. You know, I just, in Bill's story, he talks about, you know, Bill had that spiritual experience of the white light variety, and he said, God's impact on me was sudden and profound. And sometimes I can think around here, well, you know, where's mine? And, or, you know, when is God going to talk to me? When he's talking to me all the time. And I have to remember on September 23rd, 1985, I could not drink. And I hadn't been able to do that for a long time. And on September 24th, 1985, I didn't pick up a drink. And God's impact on me was sudden and profound. And that obsession was lifted. And there's some things that I have to do today. The forces that brought me here are still very much with me. I have to respect the fact that I have alcoholism. I have to treat my disease aggressively. Luckily, the treatment isn't too bad. With 19 years of sobriety, I have three meetings that I go to on a weekly basis that I have little jobs to do. I have commitments at those meetings. You know, I pass a basket or help set up chairs or something. And the reason I do that is because it trains my feet. You know, as you say, you train my feet when my head tells me otherwise. And my head tells me otherwise a lot. I don't, after I've worked all day, I don't want to go get in traffic and drive to a meeting. It's never a good idea for me to go to a meeting. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it when I get there. But I don't love it until I get there. And until I get there, my head's telling me other things. Maybe I should stay home and make amends to myself tonight. I think my throat's getting a little sore, you know. Isn't it nap time? My alarm goes off in the morning. I don't fall to my knees and say, "Oh joy, it's another day of walking hand in hand with God, meeting challenges and opportunities for growth." That's not my reaction to life. My alarm goes off and I roll over and hit snooze and go, "Damn it, damn it." You know, and immediately start thinking of what can I call in sick for and when's my next nap. You know, I keep paying that AA insurance. I keep living contrary to who I am, and I get I've learned how to, no, not today, I'm not going to listen to you, maybe tomorrow. Let me just put one foot in front of the other. Let me do what's in front of me. And a result of doing that, you know, my attitude adjusts. But it needs those adjustments a lot. So I'm new in Honolulu and scared all the time, but I'm going to meetings and I have a home group and I got a sponsor because everybody around me had a sponsor. And I started working the steps because everybody around me started working the steps. And the first three steps, you know, step one, I didn't have any problem with that. There was no doubt that I was an alcoholic. You know, I can remember in those bars I used to drink in, they stopped, they closed at 4 a.m. and they didn't reopen until 6 a.m. And I used to worry about those 2 hours of downtime in there. And because the liquor store stopped selling at midnight. You know how it gets all tricky. You've got to plan it all out. And so before my shift was over at the bar I worked at, because we closed earlier, and I'd run down. There's a little liquor store under the bar I worked at. And I'd get a couple of those little airplane-sized bottles of vodka to keep with me just in case I wasn't where I needed to be between 4 and 6 a.m., you know, not social drinking as I've come to understand it. And so first step was easy for me. And the second step, it was clear to me that I was being restored to sanity. There was still, sometimes I'd get real paranoid around here and I'd think, This is like much bigger than alcoholism. I shouldn't be this crazy. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm crazy, and they're not telling me. You know, these AAs are just humoring me. And thank God I had a sponsor to say, no, that, you know, that is alcoholism. That's what that is. And I didn't know. The third step was a little scary for me, turning my will and my life over. And because, you know, I have a Catholic education. I know what that means. I'm going to have to go join Mother Teresa's order and go off to India or Africa somewhere and be a missionary. And I've since realized that God saves those jobs for people more spiritually fit to handle them, and that wouldn't be me. So, of course, my sobriety, and Sue talked about it today, it's been a series of surrenders, and it's not, you know, this analogy goes around our program. It's not, you throw in the towel, but then you take it back and you spend the rest of your sobriety tearing off little chunks with your teeth and spitting those in. That's kind of how it is. I didn't have anything to fear about that third step. And all the stuff today I thought that AA was going to take from me, it's been conversely, actually. AA has given me things. And the fourth and fifth step, I didn't want to open that anxiety closet, you know. I was just terrified. I didn't know, you know, all that stuff I put in there. One, I thought it might be like a scream that never stops if I start putting all that stuff down on paper. And two, if I get it all out, what's gonna be behind it? Who knows? I didn't know. I got uncomfortable enough. Pain is the teacher. That I got it all down on paper, and I shared that with my sponsor. And I didn't, you know, I didn't. AA has brought an incremental revolution to my life. It's not what I want. I want a burning bush. I want nirvana. I want, you know. I want Bill's white light variety spiritual experience, and that's not what I get. And maybe sometimes I do, and I probably miss it. You know, I miss a lot of stuff. My sponsor tells me that a lot today. Don't miss today. Don't miss today, because I can. You know, there can be something right in front of me, and I can miss it. You know, what I got of doing that fifth step was that, and also, you know, there's several other steps after that one. It didn't just stop there. So I felt like you could look me in the eye and I didn't have to be afraid of what you're going to see. And I could take a light and shine it anywhere inside of me, and there wasn't going to be any little scurrying thing trying to hide in a dark corner. You know, I have swept stuff under the rug all my life, and this time, you know, under that rug it was clean, and that was a really good feeling. And there's a dear Al-Anon that I love down in Southern California, Vinoy Shah, and she says that every alcoholic woman has that little piece of white velvet in her that's never been touched. And I think we get that from the fifth step, and that's a big deal. When I had 3 years of sobriety, I moved to Los Angeles, and the old-timers in Honolulu said, you know, it's a huge fellowship. There's 2,500 meetings a week there now, and you should, you know, get a home group right away, and you could really fall through the cracks there. And that, you know, sounded like a plan, but I didn't do that because I forgot to put A first. And those expressions that we say around here, like listen for the similarities and not the differences, I thought that stuff only applied to newcomers. And after all, I have 3 years, and I, you know, I think I'm post AA now. And yeah, I'll go to meetings, but you know, I've got a plan. And exactly what they predicted happened. I fell through the cracks there. It is a huge fellowship. I was sponsorless for about a year and a half, and I'd go to meetings just kind of when the heat was on, and they didn't do it in Los Angeles the way they did it in Honolulu, and that's all I could notice. I was so busy looking at the differences that I couldn't hear the message. And I just really, you know what, I really wasn't doing well. I ended up hanging out with a bunch of old friends from Santa Cruz that I'd grown up with, a couple of whom were junkies. I mean, I just really was not doing well. Coming up on my fifth AA birthday, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I'd go to meetings when the heat was on, but I had no fellowship around me in Southern California AA. I was just kind of out there flapping in the breeze. And you can easily go to a meeting a night and never see the same person twice. So I had a couple AA contacts left in my life, my roommate at the time and a woman that I was waitressing with, and I just kind of like turned myself into them and started going to meetings where they were going to meetings. And this roommate of mine, I heard this woman speak. Some of you might know Karen Garrison because she talks a lot. She's probably been up here. at your conference, and he said, ask this woman to be your sponsor. And I was in no position to interview or anything. You know, I was desperate, which is a good place for me to be. You know, I'm not going to go out and search for the perfect sponsor as if I would know what that was anyway in the condition that I was in. And because one more time, I'm coming to meetings and I'm laughing and I'm seeing you guys laughing and talking and smiling. And I'm thinking, I'm never going to feel that way. I'll never have that light in my eyes. I'll never be comfortable in my skin. I just know that I won't. And the reason I was feeling that way is because I have seen AA from the fringes and I've seen it from the middle. And the view from the edge is very different than the view from the middle. It just is. And I'm at my best when I'm in the middle of view. And when I'm on the outside looking in, then that's how it looks. But when I get in the middle of the room one, I like to keep a lot of bodies between me and that door. You know, that's the safest place that I know. And even in nature, in a herd, the animals that get picked off are the ones that are on the outside. And I just try and today that's the best place for me to be. And when I started to get in the middle, guess what? My perceptions began to change. And so I asked Karen to sponsor me, and I told her all this long list of problems that I'd racked up in that year and a half without a sponsor. And she responded rapidly. She talks fast. And basically the same thing that Sue's sponsor said, you know, I'm not going to debate with you. We're not going to debate. And she said, I expect a lot from the people I sponsor. With your amount of sobriety, I'd like you to go to 4 meetings a week and get commitments at all of them. I want you to get a panel, and hospital institution panel. I want you to start answering phones in central office. I want you to do another fourth and fifth step with me. Call me on a regular basis. Start sponsoring other women. Get involved with your AA sisters, the other women I sponsor. And I thought, well, I have picked the wrong sponsor here. Her solutions had nothing to do with my problems at all. I thought, did you hear me? You know, but of course those problems just died of neglect. You know, they just died of neglect. And because, you know, Karen, when I got busy, I got better. And Karen knew that all that stuff was... doing all that stuff was going to get me in the middle of the room. And I was, you know, I had no foundation in Southern California AA. I had no fellowship around me and no foundation to stand on. And that doing that stuff was going to once again make me feel like a viable, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's real important for me today. And it's, you know, it's important that I give back what I've been given, that I not forget where I came from. And that stuff helped me, you know, to do that. And there's very few meetings I go to now out of those 2,500 meetings that I don't know at least someone. And I like that. You know, I like that. We're intense, lonely people who live in self-constructed prisons. I think that's in the 12 and 12. And most of the time I don't live like that anymore. And I had that panel out at the penitentiary and for a long time, and answering phones, and, you know, just kind of getting a fellowship around me and a foundation under me, and it's a foundation that I stand on today, and it feels really good to be on solid ground most of the time. That fifth step she wanted me to do, one of the things that came out on that was that I was really ashamed of the fact that I only had an eighth grade education, and I was still waiting tables. And she said, you know, honey, you can have anything you want in sobriety as long as you're willing to do the work to get it. But that was not what I wanted to hear, because now I'm in speaker meetings in LA. There's lots of speaker meetings, and you're hearing these amazing stories, you know, like my friend Clint. I was living in a garage, now I'm a lawyer. And she's like, my God, if I come to enough of these speaker meetings, I'm going to become a lawyer too. That's fantastic. But it doesn't quite work that way. I wanted to get it by osmosis, and she said, why don't you go and take your GED exam and get your high school diploma? Oh, yeah, that's going to change my life. Thanks. You know, I thought it. I didn't say it. One, I thought, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I know I can't pass. And then on the other hand, I thought, high school diploma? How about a PhD? You know how we are. Perfection or nothing. But I didn't, you know, I didn't have any better ideas. I thought that has absolutely nothing to do with anything in my life. But I did it. And another member of my home group heard I was doing it, also somebody who got sober in 1985, and he said that, you know, I heard you're, you know, I'll go with you. I've never gotten mine either. And so we started taking classes at a night school. It was in 92, I remember, because the riots happened at that time, and then we were under curfew and couldn't go for a while. And I of course, I take that as my sign from God that, I can stop now. But I'd been going to meet as if the L.A. riots had, were a personal message to me. but I'd been going to meetings long enough and that because we have a saying at my home group that you're there to do your commitment unless there's a death in the family and it's yours. And that's the type of structure that I need, reinforcing that all the time, but, showing up no matter what, in spite of how it looks to me, I needed to show up and leave the results to God. And at 28, I became a high school graduate. I passed that test and got my equivalency certificate, and that was a really big deal. I had written that off as wreckage of the past, and I didn't even know it was going to be a big deal. And I'm so grateful for sponsorship, and that I have no objectivity about my life, but somebody else does. And there's something about, and I don't know where my answers come from either, and there's something about when I'm willing to surrender and someone else is willing to be of service, that God can come in there in that space in between. Now, if I step into that space and take back my will, or my sponsor gives me a direction and I'm going to take it partially, or I'm going to, maybe I'll do this part of it but not this part of it, I'm in that space there and God can't get in. That's just been my experience again and again. I've asked, one time my sponsor gave me a suggestion, and it turned out to be life-changing. And I said, Marianne, how did you know that? How did you know that that was the right thing to do? My sponsor today is Marianne Wallin. She just celebrated 40 years, and she said, I didn't. I didn't know. I just know I didn't mean you any harm. I just know I didn't mean you any harm. And, she'll tell me the same thing about women I sponsor. You can't hurt them. If you're willing to be of service and your heart's in the right place, you can't hurt them. And I've seen that work again and again. And I started going to a community college. Karen said, start taking some classes, and I did that. And it wasn't the first community college I'd been to, it was the third. Because I go to a community college, and I start taking classes, and in my mind, in a month or so, I'm going to be the president of that college. But then you say something to me like, well, there's a prerequisite, and you have to take this course before you can take this. Oh, see, I knew it. Forget it. I want to do it my way, but I go in with some big plan, and I didn't do that this time. I didn't go in with any big plans because Karen said, honey, just take the next indicated action. And I was just desperate enough because I guess I had like 7 or 8 years of sobriety by this time, still waiting tables, and just felt so stuck, and I was desperate enough to just do what someone else suggested. And there was one thing that I did very few things right there, but the one thing I did right when I was going to that school was that I showed up, and I didn't know that was the big secret, and I learned that here, of course. I showed up on the days I was too dumb and the days I was too smart and every day in between, which was probably one day, because, it's always one or the other. I just kept going no matter what. And by the time I left, and I used to think, well, I can't go to school, I don't know anything, and I've since learned that's exactly what they're there for. It's okay. School. I don't know what I want to do, or how will I pay for it, blah, blah, blah. Always the cart before the horse. Always the cart before the horse. But Karen would just, honey, just do what's in front of you. And eventually a plan evolved in a way, I learned along the way. Had I not, but it was, I have to step out on the path and let it unfold. If I never stepped out on the path, it never could have unfolded. And I was there for about 3 years, and by the time I left there, I had three little jobs on that campus. They weren't big deals. They were like filing for professors or tutoring and stuff, but they were to me. I was 28 or 29, and they were my first jobs above minimum wage and beyond physical labor, and I was able to cut back on my shifts at the restaurant because I just wanted to wake up one day and not be a waitress, And 17 years went by while I was waiting for me to wake up and not be a waitress. And it turned out to be a very gradual process. I had to cut back. I was able to cut back to 4 shifts and then 3 shifts. And I eventually a plan did develop, and I wanted to transfer to a university and be an English major. And Karen said, we'll start doing the footwork for that. And I decided I wanted to go to UCLA. And I couldn't meet their math requirement. I took the lowest level math class, I had to take that twice. And I spent an extra year and a half at that community college taking math and failing and taking math and failing and taking math and failing and hiring tutors and listening to math anxiety tapes and trying to, you know, all different, every form and computer-instructed math and video-instructed math and class math and small group math. And just, it was very, very frustrating. And but I learned here from you guys about doing footwork, and so I finally went and had myself tested for a learning disability. And I was told that I did indeed have a learning disability in math, a really severe learning disability. I tested in the second percentile. And I don't know a lot about numbers, but I know there's only one number below the below two. So, and she drew an arrow pointing down. So, and I was told in that Office of Student Disabilities that I would not have a university education. And I should maybe set my sights lower on maybe a non-accredited school or a vocational school. But nobody in AA told me that, and my sponsor didn't tell me that. And I've since I work in education today, I know that one no means very little, and they didn't mean me any harm. They were just misinformed. And Karen said, honey, you just keep knocking on doors, and you just keep trying. And I did that, and I applied to UCLA against the advice of the Office of Student Disabilities and against the advice of my counselor. And in June of 97, I put on a cap and gown for the first time in my life. I was 33 years old, I guess, and about 11 years sober, and graduated from UCLA with a degree in English, and I got to give the commencement address at that graduation ceremony, and my mom was, the best part about that day was that my mom was there. She got to sit in the VIP section, and she had her scholar back. It was, you know, really a gift from you guys, no doubt about it. Another member of my home group also graduated that day, and we had a big party at the A meeting hall place at Ohio Street, and it was a really good day. But I didn't realize at the time that I was putting a lot of expectations on that degree. And don't get me wrong, that, you know, going to school has been, it's been great, but guess what? It's not a cure for alcoholism. And I thought, once I have that degree, I'll be confident in everything I do, and I'll never have another human emotion. I don't think I verbalized it that way, but, you know, it was all going to be different now, once I could put BA behind my name. And I just really kind of floundered for a while. And you know, when you're in school and people ask you, what are you going to do when you're done? And you, I didn't really know, but they want an answer. And so I started saying, I'm going to teach for a year and go to graduate school. But there's a part of me that never really thought I'd ever finish school, because it just seemed like it was impossible. And then I did finish school, and I thought, oh my God, now I have to teach for a year and then go to graduate school. And I'm looking for jobs, and I really just floundered for a while. And I was, I thought some perfect job would fall in my lap, and I wouldn't, you know, I would just, I don't know, I wouldn't be afraid, or it wouldn't be difficult, and it was. And I, for about 6 months, I was looking for work, and not really that hard, actually, because I was terrified. I was terrified. I had to take that leap out there, and I was scared to death. A friend of mine, and I'm, you know, saying the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, and God, where should I serve, and what would you have me do? And a girlfriend of mine in the program kept saying to me, you know, we really need a teacher at where I teach. It's a special ed middle school, LA Unified, you know, in Gardena. Why don't you come and take the job? And I was like, no way, no special ed, no middle school. You know, that eye-rolling, chicken-necking age. Remember how you were at, like, 13? Oh. Where's Gardena and no LA Unified? None of the above. Come on, I read the LA Times. 900,000 students, 50% of whom are failing? Don't think so. Short 45,000 seats? No. But she was relentless about it, you know, and I kept praying, God, what should I do? Where would you have me serve? And she's over here, you know. This went on from September to February. And I was just, you know, barely hanging on financially, and I'd look in the want ads and think, maybe I'll just get a, you know, actually I took this part-time job teaching kindergarten, and I was like an after-school program, and I was just terrified, absolutely terrified. And I'd call my sponsor and say, I can't do it, I can't, I'm going to call in sick. She'd say, if you do that, you'll never walk in a classroom again. And I knew she was right. I cannot give in to that fear. And I had reason to be terrified. They say things like, is that your real hair? Because you look like you have some other hair underneath. And I think, little those little kindergartners. Anyway, I made the mistake of mentioning this job to my sponsor, and I said to her, there's this one job I can get at Special Ed Middle School, LA Unified. Nobody wants those jobs, which is true, and that's why I can get the job. And I felt the old sponsor chill come over the phone, when you've taken it just a little too far. And she said, as the mother of a former special ed student, I think that you could really be of service there, and I think you know in your heart that's where you're supposed to be. And the minute she said that, I did know in my heart that's where I was supposed to be. But that was not the answer that I wanted, And I didn't know that that God did such a good impression on my friend Lisa, And when I'm praying for the fear to be removed, I just mean make me not afraid. I didn't mean send me to 163rd in Normandy to some out-of-control middle school class and make me walk through the fear. That's not what I mean at all. But that's usually not, but it seems to work for me that way. And the extent of my training, a lot of problems. 3,000 kids on a campus built for 1,500, California ranks their schools on a scale of 1 to 10. 10 is the highest. The school is a 2. Just lots of problems. And the extent of the training was room 5, here's the key, see at 3. And, I try to tell my friend Lisa, I have no train for teaching special ed. And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best train I've ever had for teaching special ed. And she's been really right about that. And this was the students who mostly learned disabled, primarily a lot of behavior problems, almost all group home kids, and really severe, horrific experiences. One child that comes to mind, he had no fingers on one hand. His grandmother had burned him off. The same year, both his parents had been murdered in separate drug situations. He'd been in 7 foster care placements, and he came to us because his grandmother was now released from prison and a judge had placed him back in her home. These kids had big problems in addition to their learning disabilities, big problems. And all that stuff showed up in the classroom, and I would think, I cannot do this, I cannot do this. They had not had a teacher from, and don't get me wrong, I did not make any miracles happen. Michelle Pfeiffer's not going to play me in any movie. I'd love to be one of those teacher movies where then they all went to Harvard. It was not like that. I came on in February. They'd had a different, day-to-day subs all year long, and it was just crazy. And I thought, I just can't do this. And Marion said, yeah, you can. They gave the key to you, and she said, you don't have a cure for that. You can't what they're bringing to the room. You don't. You just but they need a teacher, and that you can do. You have information for them. And I thought, what do I know best? And what I know best is Alcoholics Anonymous. And, when I come here, it's always the same. The same things are read. There's coffee to be made. There's a structure and a sameness here that in the chaos of my world and what's in my head, I find very comforting. And I thought, well, I can do. I can impose that in my classroom. You're kind to me. You remember my name. And I can do that. And I started trying to use, A as my model. And I started trying to look at them the way that you looked at me. And you never said to me, how long have you been waiting tables? And you're going to do what? You're going to try to go to what school? And no matter how torn up somebody is when they come in, we might think it like, oh man, they'll never make it. But we don't think it. Because we know there's something greater at work here. And we're all walking dead here. So, and why can't, if that power works here, why can't it also, work in their lives? Who am I to say that, because they live in the Bright Future group home, have, so many problems that they're not, and teacher expectation is important for student success. And so I, on the days when I can do that, and I also have to remember that, in spite of all the forms of insanity that we've come from, and I know there have been many, I don't know you, but I know you've been there, sanity prevails in this room this afternoon. We shouldn't look like this or laugh like this or any of it. It shouldn't happen. But yet it does. And so I tried to do that, and I got through that year. I got through that year, and so it turned out that AA was the best train I'd ever had for teaching special ed. But I had my plan that I was going to stick to, which was to go to graduate school because I wanted to teach community college English. And I went up to Stanford, and I got a master's degree in English, and I didn't put any big, you know, that was great, but I didn't put quite the same expectations on it that I had the bachelor's degree, thank goodness, but I still wanted what I wanted, and I didn't get what I wanted. I wanted a full-time community college teaching position. I didn't get that, but I got a part-time one, and so for a year and a half, I was on the faculty at Pasadena City College, which is where my sponsor sent me to start taking one class, and where my learning disability was diagnosed, and I taught English there for a year and a half, but I found that my heart was really at 163rd in Normandy teaching special ed, and I didn't, you know, I didn't want that to be the case. I really didn't. You know, it didn't have quite the, you know, I thought, well, you know, UCLA, Stanford, and then Perry Middle School, home of the Huskies. Not quite the ring I was hoping for, but when I'm in the classroom, most of the time, and I make a lot of mistakes, I really do, and some days I think, you know, God, are you sure? I'm the most impatient, intolerant person on the earth, and this is the job you want for me? And you really meet yourself there in your students. But most of the time, at least once a day, I don't want to be anywhere else. I'm not waiting for my real life to start. I feel comfortable and usefully whole. That's a pretty good deal. I'm not thinking there's something else out there for me, you know. It also meant, though, that I needed yet more school, and so I had to get a teaching credential. It just seemed like it would never, it's still not over. But I was able to get a grant to do that and get my teaching credential, I still, you know, have to clear it, and there's things. I'm at a new school this year. I had a long commute, and I switched schools, and that's been kind of an adjustment for me. But I have to think that it's where I'm supposed to be. You know, one thing I realized a lot of that guilt and shame that I felt about stuff that went on out in my drinking, about those pregnancies that I terminated, and even though that I had shared that on a fifth step and done that, I didn't know how I could amend that, and it occurred to me, you know, not that long ago that working in where I work, I mean, and truly the kids that I worked with are absolutely unwanted kids. I mean, nobody, you know, the teachers don't want them in the rooms, the system doesn't want them, their parents are MIA for the most part. And it was a way for me to kind of make that, to get some peace with that. I had that opportunity to kind of balance the scales. I've had that opportunity to balance the scales there a little bit. And I would have, you know, I would have missed that whole thing if I hadn't taken, you know, went ahead and taken that job, which I knew was absolutely the wrong thing for me. It was the wrong thing. I was quite sure. But I have enough experience in, you know, taking and maybe trying your idea instead of mine that, some, you know, things can work out, and it has. You know, my life is not perfect. I have a lot of debt. I'm, you know, paying for school. I don't necessarily like that. I'd like to be able to take my clothes to the dry cleaners, things like that. But, you know, it's life on life's terms. But it's certainly better than the life that I brought here. It really is. I think that's it. I don't want to start lying, so I better sit down. I'll just finish with a favorite quote of mine. It's in the book, and then it's rewritten again, and as Bill sees it, and it's that outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic event out of the past, but we have recovered and are helping others to recover, and what greater cause could there be for rejoicing than this? I want to thank you so much for listening. Most importantly, I want to thank you for my life.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.